From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. You might remember a few months ago, storyteller Eve Abram shared the tale of Charles Mitchell, the teenage slave from Olympia who escaped to freedom. A lot of the research she had from that comes from a book that just came out by Museum of History and Industry's public historian Lorraine McConaghy. She's co-written the book on Charles Mitchell, the man and the man who owned him, James Tilton. The book is called Slave Boy. Lorraine McConaghy, thank you for coming back. We really appreciate it. I just am fascinated about this story because of the window it gives to a previously unknown to me early days of Washington State. We're talking about the 1850s when Washington was still a territory. Were there many slaves here then?
No, there really weren't. We know of two. Charles Mitchell is one. We know of a second at Fort Steilacoom during the Civil War. And she does not appear in a census, but she does appear in correspondence. So I think that in this sesquicentennial of the Civil War, it's kind of our obligation to understand what happened here in the late antebellum wartime and early Reconstruction periods, about which we are taught very, very little.
Well, there was a huge debate at the time in the eastern part of the United States over slavery, of course, and that led to the Civil War. Was that kind of giant, huge debate taking place here in the Washington Territory?
Yes, it was. I mean, one of the big changes that Freeboy has capitalized on is the digitization of newspapers that make it so much easier is maybe not quite the right adjective, but it certainly is not as hard to do primary source research now that you can do keyword searching, read online, and so forth. So the newspapers of Washington Territory in that period are dramatically different in their approach to slavery, to its expansion, to states' rights, to whether the Republican Party was revolutionary or radical in seeking to abolish slavery in the United States or to punish secession.
Let's talk a little bit about James Tilton, the man who owned Charles Mitchell. When he was back east in Maryland, he had political connections with politicians who favored leaving slavery alone, and he shared those beliefs.
Yeah, well, he was a pro-expansionist, pro-slavery, pro-states' rights Democrat. And he met the man who would become President, Franklin Pierce, when they were comrades in the war with Mexico and joined a club together called the Aztec Club. They liked each other. They shared the same ideas. And James Tilton worked very, very hard to elect Franklin Pierce to the presidency. The reward for that kind of service is a patronage job. And as long as Washington was a territory, so 1853 to 1889, our governors and almost all of the significant officials in the territory were appointed by patronage as a reward for their political work. So that's how James Tilton was given the award of becoming Surveyor General of Washington Territory.
Did James Tilton own slaves back east in Maryland, I guess, where he was from?
No, he grew up in Indiana. He was born in Delaware, but his mother's family were from the Gibson side of the Tilton-Gibson, very complicated family tree, and they owned Marengo Plantation in Talbot County, Maryland, and that's where Charles Mitchell was born, the slave who ran away on this tiny underground railroad on Puget Sound.
How did he come to be the possession of James Tilton and come out here?
Well, there's more than one story. Certainly the hottest, most provocative one is that the child was given as a wedding gift to James Tilton and his wife. Whatever the circumstances were, he was given to the Tilton family in Maryland to take to Washington Territory. And the precise relationship of this black child whose mother had died in 1850, a slave on Marengo Plantation, and the Tilton family is interesting and fascinating to explore, because in the big paper trail that surrounds his flight to Victoria, the boy was variously called a slave, property, an employee, a ward, like a son to him, and Tilton given all sort of the opposite nouns of those relationships.
And so when he came here, this was in Olympia, right?
Yes.
The young boy, Charles Mitchell, he was an early teenager. I understand he was approached by abolitionists about perhaps leaving. They recognized him as a slave. They wanted to get him out of that situation.
Yes, and he had arrived here at 8 and lived in the territory for almost 5 years before a black cook on board the international mail steamer Eliza Anderson noticed him. This black child, you know, ripped out of his family in Marengo and sent to the far side of the world, a very lonely child in largely white Washington Territory, went back to Victoria and held conversations there. This is a time when Victoria was 25% black. That's just spectacular. And many of those black families had come from California. So they were very familiar with the Fugitive Slave Act, with slavery in the United States, and they reached out to this child, cooking up a conspiracy that would approach him in Olympia and encourage him to run away.
And he did it. He was encouraged, and so Charles Mitchell jumped on a ship that was headed towards Canada, but he was discovered en route.
He was, and it was very carefully planned. The cook on board the Eliza Anderson met Charles Mitchell at the dock on September 24th, 1860, at dawn, and snuck him on board and hid him in a pantry downstairs in the galley, which he could do. He was the cook. But along the way, perhaps here in Seattle, again, there's more than one story about this, and the difficulties that Judy Bentley and I faced were negotiating through the swamp, hopping from dry space to dry space. But there is one dry space, one story, that says that in searching for deserters from the army at Fort Steilacoom in Seattle, a small company came on board to hunt for deserters, and they found Charles Mitchell instead.
And the captain was so upset, he wanted to put Charles Mitchell on the ship going back to Olympia, as I understand it.
He did, but he couldn't find one. So he took him to Victoria instead.
And this is amazing. As the ship arrives, there are hundreds of people on shore waiting for Charles Mitchell.
Well, we don't know quite how many,
That's
but there
story.
Were many, many, many. And they were, as the pioneer and Democrat put it, white humanitarians and free blacks. And they were waiting for Charles Mitchell because this conspiracy of this tiny little underground railroad of Puget Sound was very real. The people at the Victoria end, the crown colony of Victoria, where there was no slavery, were expecting the boy to walk off the vessel.
And there was once he arrived there, this turned into a giant legal dispute because it was illegal to have a slave in Victoria, whereas it was at least acknowledged that it could happen here in Washington Territory.
Well, and the captain had put Charles Mitchell under arrest on board the ship, telling him that he had seen him in James Tilton's house in Olympia and that he was going to return him and that the boy was going to work his way and that he wasn't going to release him. So this did become a legal case, and that made a paper trail for people like Judy and I to investigate. So it's the newspapers, but then it becomes affidavits, testimony in court, newspaper articles that detail this newspaper process, this judicial process. But the basic thing is that an attorney in Victoria gathered affidavits from three black men in Victoria detailing this flight and then asked the sheriff for a writ of habeas corpus to seize Charlie Mitchell from the ship, arguing that the captain had no legal right to hold the boy under lock and key on board a ship that was moored in Victoria's harbor. And after some legal wrangling and some back and forth, the sheriff was able to take Charles Mitchell under that writ of habeas corpus, put him in jail overnight, and then there was a hearing the next morning. And Charles Mitchell was freed into the loving arms of the black community in Victoria.
Did James Tilton make a claim for this man, this boy who was his former slave? Did he try to get him back? Did he claim he had to run away?
He did. And it's very interesting to see how the Democratic newspapers, who were on, if you will, Tilton's side in Washington Territory, argued that he was glad the boy was gone and he didn't want him back. But in actual fact, Tilton and the captain of the Eliza Anderson filed protests, and Tilton's went directly to the acting governor of Washington Territory, who in turn filed his own protest with the United States Secretary of State that the British had improperly interfered with a United States captain on board a United States vessel and that they had no right to do so.
That's such an interesting discrepancy. It was Tilton telling the newspaper is one thing while through legal means doing something else? Or can we even discern that?
Oh, yes, you absolutely can. It's perfectly clear that he said one thing publicly and did another thing privately. But what we did in Free Boy was to twine together the biography of James Tilton with that of Charles Mitchell, because this event affected both of them, the boy and the man.
If you just joined us, I'm talking to Lorraine McConaghy. She's the co-author of a book called Slave Boy. Excuse me.
It's called Free Boy.
Free Boy, excuse me.
Sorry.
I keep saying the wrong name, Free Boy, about a boy who was a slave and who was freed in Washington Territory at the time, going to Canada. And what was kind of the lasting impact of this case?
Well, I think it's 1865 when James Tilton ran for delegate of Washington Territory, and he ran against Arthur Denny running as an abolitionist Republican pro-union man, and Tilton running as a frank white supremacist on the Democratic ticket. The rhetoric of this election is fascinating, and I think we see in it the shadow of Charlie Mitchell, the fury of James Tilton at what he considered the ingratitude of this 13-year-old boy running away from the life that Tilton had planned for him. There's a sense in this racial hierarchy of the 1850s in which someone like Tilton had grown up, participated, believed in, that people of color were either childlike or dangerous, and that if you were at the top of the racial hierarchy, you had to control them or you had to make choices for them. And, you know, he had Charles Mitchell's life laid out for him, and Mitchell chose a different path. He remade his life despite the circumstances in which he found himself. That's why Judy and I thought this book was important to do.
So this was a major campaign issue in the Tilton-Denny race then?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And it was. Do you think it was the deciding issue? Did people in Washington Territory decide they were not going to go with this view of how black people should be treated?
One could make that generalization, but I think even more it was the death of Abraham Lincoln, that the assassination threw a sort of cloak of rectitude and honor around Denny, and that Tilton, whose newspaper, the Washington Democrat, had printed the most scurrilous gossip about Lincoln, that he was going to put aside his white wife and take up a sable wench to begin the great work of miscegenation. I mean, that kind of thing really came back to haunt Tilton in the campaign. He lost resoundingly, but it's very hard to pull out why people in 1865
sure.
voted one way or the other. But in my opinion, this was a very racist territory. You can find a lot of abolitionists who were eager to free the slaves, but not particularly eager to work, socialize, or vote with free blacks.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened to James Tilton after he lost that election? What became of him?
Well, his supporters during the election claimed that even though he had come west as a sort of fawning little toady with a patronage job, he had put deep roots down in Washington Territory and would remain. That didn't happen. He took his family and was away on a steamer within a short while after losing the election. He was a very fine surveyor and civil engineer, and the rest of his life through 1878, he worked in a variety of canal projects, railroad projects, drainage projects, waterworks projects, and never was involved in politics again.
And what of the freed slave boy, Charles Mitchell? Do we know what became of him?
This is where, Judy, it was wonderful to work with another historian because we really had to slug this out. This is an unbalanced story of power where the master has such a huge leverage of power in life. The slave has such a low leverage of power. And that plays out after death. So archivally, oh, man, I could tell you more than you want to know about James Tilton. But Charles Mitchell, aside from the month that there was a lot of coverage of his escape and the little paper trail in British Columbia, he disappears. So in 1870, we faced the dilemma of two dozen mulatto or black young men, so called by the census enumerator, in Canada and in the United States who were 23 years of age and named Charles Mitchell. Which one is ours? So in our book, we did the best arguing, we did the best research that we could to choose the pathway that we think is our Charles Mitchell, if you'll forgive me putting it that way. We believe that he died in 1876. We believe that he died in Victoria working as a lumberman. Before that, we believe that our Charles Mitchell in the 1870 census is the Charles Mitchell who's 23 and mulatto in Baltimore. It made human sense to us that after the Civil War, he would go back to Marengo and try to find his family, from whom he had been ripped. So that's the chance we took. We also ended each of our chapters with an italicized section that is speculative. In order to balance this unbalanced story, to give Charles Mitchell motivation, characterization, and give him a storyline equivalent to his master's.
It must be frustrating in some ways to be working with imperfect sources and not really know the answers to things. If you could get the answer to one question you have about the Charles Mitchell story that you couldn't answer from your research, what would that be?
Oh, my gosh. I think more than anything, I would like to know if he was the Charles Mitchell in Baltimore in 1870, because that return to his family is at the core of our speculation about his character and his motivation. But one thing we did do in April on blackpast.org, Dr. Quintard Taylor's website, a feature of the primary documents with which Judy and I worked and struggled will become live so that students and educators and researchers all over can look at what we looked at, work it through, and reach their own conclusions.
Lorraine McConaghy, thank you so much for telling us about this. I really appreciate it.
It's my great pleasure.
The book is called Free Boy, The True Story of a Slave and a Master. It's by Lorraine McConaghy, and your co-author again is
Judy Bentley.
Julie Bentley.